Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking with Greg Heller, who's the author of a slightly different type of book than I normally review and talk about, which is more of a biography of a figure, a prominent architect, planner, but also a policy entrepreneur. The book is called Ed Bacon, Planning Politics and the Building of Modern Philadelphia. It's published by Penn Press this year. I hope that you really enjoy this interview. Greg, how are you doing?
Good. Good to be with you, Heath.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Really interesting. A different book for me to read in this context. But as I hope we'll talk about, it's a really political book in many ways, as was Ed Bacon's life. But before we get to it, maybe you can introduce yourself a little bit. What your background is, where you are now. You're not a traditional academic, though you've written a very academic book. So tell us about yourself.
Sure. I went to college at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and I created sort of a multifaceted major that, urban studies major that involved both political science and history, art history. So I came out with kind of a diverse educational background and started doing work right after college doing community development and affordable housing. I'll explain in a second how I got there, but I did that for a little while, and then I worked for the Metropolitan Planning Organization for Philadelphia called the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission for a few years, doing a lot of policy and planning work. And then I went from there to head up a community development corporation, where we did economic development, physical development projects. And the beginning of this year, I started my own company doing urban real estate investment projects and economic development work. So that's the quick overview. But the way I really got into all of this was through Ed Bacon, the subject of the book, who I met after my junior year of college. After my junior year of college, I was home in Philadelphia interning at the Philadelphia City Planning Commission and working on a thesis that was going to be about planning in Philadelphia, and everybody suggested I needed to touch base with Ed Bacon, who at the time was in his 90s. So I wrote him a letter. He invited me to come over for an interview. We spent an afternoon together. He took me out to lunch and asked me to take off a year of school and help him write his memoir. And I did that, and it was a remarkable year. I recorded hundreds of hours of taped interviews with Ed Bacon, met all kinds of important people in the field. Got to see his whole archive that he was keeping in his house, and it was really very transformative for me about how I looked at urban spaces and urban policy, and it really changed my whole trajectory. And so it was really through that after I graduated college, I started going and trying to work in that field of urban development.
Yeah, it's such an interesting way to come to this luminary, even if maybe not a luminary to everyone, as we'll talk about. He really carved out some new ground in this field of planning, but not just in planning. And you know, he takes on, and your experience must have been you know, a little like interviewing one of these ad men from the Mad Men TV show, looking back on that same kind of era. When was Ed Bacon making his name? What is the time period that really establishes him as such an important figure in urban planning?
Well, Ed Bacon was city planning director of Philadelphia from 1949 through 1970. But as I try and explain in the book, there are several periods where he was very influential, but in different ways. He cut his teeth working in urban planning and affordable housing in Flint, Michigan in the 1930s during the WPA, the Works Progress Administration under Roosevelt's New Deal. And then the main portion of his career as planning director of Philadelphia was under urban renewal, another era of big federal spending on cities. But then he had a very active several decades after he retired from the City Planning Commission, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, working for a private real estate firm and doing a number of projects as an independent practitioner. during obviously a period of much less public money available for cities and general urban decline in Philadelphia and across America. And so one of the big things I try and touch in the book is looking at Ed Bacon in these different periods and how he did what he did and what resources were available and kind of what the changing scene was around urban planning and development in Philadelphia, but also nationally.
Yeah, and I want to talk about some of the Bacon as a political figure. But before we get to that, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what I know least about, which is sort of the architectural dimension of Bacon's career. Let's just sort of start there. And so when we visit Philadelphia today, which parts of Philadelphia are part of Bacon's legacy? Are there iconic architectural contributions that we would still see today that stand out, that are his the result of his work particularly?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's a much more complicated question than one would think. One of the themes I actually have in my book is that while Ed Bacon is associated with the physical planning of Philadelphia during this 21-year period, he actually designed almost nothing. And many of the ideas that he became associated with were other people's ideas. And the architects who ended up actually designing buildings that are in urban spaces that he's associated with were not actually his design and were things that he had very little influence on. And so I really try to disconnect Bacon from the physical architecture and spatial design, which is what he's often associated with, and try and connect him more with the political maneuvering behind the scenes, which I think was really his contribution and which he receives much less, it's seen as not as strongly connected to what he was doing. He's largely seen as someone who had an influence on the physical realm, and I'm trying to reframe the lens that we look at him as looking at him as more of someone who worked in the political policy realm is the short answer.
Yeah, and indicative of that, I wonder if maybe if you could sort of retell one or two of the anecdotes of the interactions between Bacon and Louis Kahn, who is another notable from that era, I forgot exactly what the encounter was, but Kahn's deep obsessive focus on design elements that's juxtaposed with Bacon's focus, which is different in some ways. Is there an encounter that illustrates Bacon's approach, architectural approach, that is less design focused and more planning focused?
Yeah, absolutely. Just stepping back a bit. So during this period, there were people who were the figurehead of each city's urban renewal, city rebuilding program. In New York, it was very much Robert Moses. In Boston, it was Ed Loeb. In a place like Baltimore, slightly later, it was someone like Jim Rouse, a real estate developer. And so one of the themes that I hit on is that Bacon, perhaps uniquely, was a city planning director who became recognized as the figurehead of this city building period of urban renewal. And I look at the question of why in other cities it was a development figure and in Philadelphia it was a planner. While looking at that question, it gets to one of the complexities of Bacon is what he was and what role he played. And so he really did cross between these two worlds of architecture and design and policy, politics, and real estate, which few people, I think, bridged as much as Bacon did. And he was trained as an architect. When you get to something like Ed Bacon's relationship to Lou Kahn, it's very complicated because Lou Kahn was an architect, and Lou Kahn felt that I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but something like, if your ideas are right, the politicians and others will come to you and will build your ideas. And Ed Bacon was the complete opposite. He believed that it was the job of people who design both you know, planning and buildings and policy, to have to sell those ideas to the right stakeholders and build a constituency and get those ideas into the pipeline of implementation in the ways that it needs to move them forward. And this is very different from the way that Kahn and probably many architects thought about how ideas are presented and then built, you know, where an architect has a client who pays the architect and then builds it. So Ed Bacon, as far as I could tell, always thought that Lew Kahn was a very brilliant architect, but I don't think he thought much of his political savvy. And so the key example that I use in the book of this was around Penn Center, which is this cluster of buildings, office buildings right across from Philadelphia's City Hall, that in the early 50s was still occupied by the Pennsylvania Railroad's massive viaduct that ran right through the western part of Center City and really degraded the value of the real estate in this whole area because you had this huge railroad viaduct. And the Pennsylvania Railroad for decades had been talking about tearing down this viaduct and freeing up this land. And when the time finally came, the railroad's philosophy of what to do with it was to sell this land off piecemeal to a variety of different developers because they didn't believe there was a lot of value to this real estate. And Ed Bacon, as well as others, including Lew Kahn, felt that this real estate could become very valuable and could become a new civic center for Philadelphia if the Pennsylvania Railroad would develop it properly. And so Bacon and Lew Kahn sat on this committee of the Philadelphia American Institute of Architects, and they developed a model for what this property could look like, and it was this very grand vision stretching for, I think it was something like 11 blocks with these towers with a pedestrian promenade underneath them. And essentially what happened was that Ed Bacon ended up going rogue and working with a different architect whose name was Vincent Kling. And so I look at why Ed Bacon decided not to work with Lew Kahn and the AIA committee, but to kind of go off and do his own thing. And it seems pretty clear when you look at Vincent Kling's qualifications. He was a corporate architect who worked well with business clients. The Pennsylvania Railroad already was his client. And he lived in the same building as the vice president of the Pennsylvania Railroad, who was the heir apparent to become president, and sat next to him at the dinner table every night. And so Ed Bacon identified this was the type of person who could get him access to the Pennsylvania Railroad's upper management and board of directors and successfully be able to sell this idea to the right stakeholders. And indeed, they were successful getting the ear of the Pennsylvania Railroad, in large part thanks to Vincent Kling's connections and savvy as an architect who could work well with corporate clients. So the point of this whole thing is that at the end of the day, Vincent Kling's design looked very similar to Lew Kahn's design. It was one block rather than 11 blocks. But at the end of the day, it wasn't about design. It was about marketing ideas. It was about networking, and it was about coalition building in order to sell an idea and get it into the pipeline. And in this case, it was a private corporation that owned the land. And so Ed Bacon's feeling was that he needed to reach you know, this corporate entity to sell the idea. So anyway, the short of it is that Ed Bacon really did span these worlds between design and politics. But at the end of the day, he was really a political entity and policy implementer. And at times, it did put him at odds with architects like Lew Kahn in a pretty significant way.
Yeah, and in the book, you describe him, and I know you've described him in other interviews, as a policy entrepreneur using John Kingdon's terminology, which would be familiar to political scientists. When you met with Bacon, when you interviewed him, and you described that these were long, long interviews, did he describe himself in these terms? How much is this idea part of his own vision? Was he conscious of this strategy? Was this something that sort of just came naturally to him? Or is this a function of something else? Maybe just talk about a little bit about interviewing him and trying to how much of this was his own self-conception.
Sure. I think Ed Bacon very well knew what he was doing, and he was a very good salesman and marketer of ideas. And one of the things that he sold and marketed aggressively was a picture of himself, the way that he wanted to be perceived and the way he wanted his legacy to be remembered. And that didn't always mesh with what he was actually doing. So throughout his career, he very much sold himself as a physical planner, and he would give these presentations talking about the urban design of Rome and Paris and London and how Philadelphia is connected to the history of urban design and planning. He's very focused on design, architecture, planning, aesthetics. And he really didn't talk about his political and policy posturing that he was doing behind the scenes. And I think that was very intentional. I think he did not want a lot of attention to be paid to Ed Bacon, the policy entrepreneur, because I think he wanted to be able to quietly be able to work his deals in the background and then build public excitement and get the media excited around the physical design, the architecture, the planning. And to a large degree, it really worked. He sold a vision a picture of himself very differently from the Ed Bacon who was actually being effective in the meeting rooms and halls of City Hall. And when I interviewed him, he sold himself this same way. He talked about the power of the idea. And so in interview after interview, and you can find tons of articles about him, he sells himself as someone who created design concepts, and these design concepts were built based on the power of the idea, that people were inspired by these designs that they saw. And he really doesn't talk about the policy entrepreneurship. So I felt like I really had to see through this. And initially I bought it too, especially when I was working with him. And in fact, I wrote a thesis at Wesleyan after I finished my year working with him called The Power of an Idea. So I was totally sold on this idea that it wasn't necessarily the political maneuvering, but the design idea itself that was so influential. But after I started working on the biography project, which, by the way, took me 6 years to research and write, I got a very different picture of Bacon, especially reading his confidential weekly report to the mayors, which are all at the University of Pennsylvania's Architectural Archives. And when you delve into it, and you look at his correspondence and his weekly reports and the meetings he was having, and you see what he was really doing, it's very different than the way he sold himself and probably the way he wanted his legacy to be portrayed.
And in talking about this, what comes out is Bacon's ideology and what some of his beliefs were. You've touched on some of them, but throughout the book you talk about his orientation towards public input and his interest in getting the public behind a project. If you could talk a little bit about his ideology more specifically and whether his ideology is somehow different than planners of his generation. Is that a piece of Bacon that makes him distinctive from the others who are working in New York and in Baltimore and in Boston and in other his contemporaries?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to go back a little bit to understand where Bacon was coming from. He was doing his early work. First of all, after college, he traveled the world and ended up working in Shanghai in China as an architect of all places, because there actually was a pretty big building boom in Shanghai at the time. And after he came back from Shanghai, he started working for an architect in Philadelphia who was the architect of record for this workers' housing project that was actually designed by an unregistered immigrant architect named Oskar Stanarov. And Stanarov got Bacon into this group of very influential kind of young progressives who were focusing on affordable housing and good community design as a way to uplift the poor and urban workers. And this included big names like Catherine Bauer and Lewis Mumford. And so Bacon got brought into this circle that was focused at the time on design and architecture as a social force that could influence people's lives and lift them out of poverty and have them be in more healthy, productive type of environment. And this whole philosophy was hugely influential on Bacon, and he applied to the Cranbrook Academy of Art in Michigan with an application that said he wanted to focus on architecture and the social impacts of it. And when he got to Cranbrook, Eliel Saarinen, who was then the president, sent him on a to carry out a study in Flint, Michigan, which at the time was a fairly successful auto manufacturing hub, but that was seeing some pretty significant issues of urban growth and poverty and housing conditions. And so Bacon started working there and kind of extended what he was supposed to be doing, which was largely around traffic, to a larger comprehensive plan for Flint that focused on affordable housing and rebuilding urban center. And he actually created a coalition of groups that were specifically focusing on affordable housing and trying to bring in new resources from Washington for subsidized affordable housing in Flint, and got himself into a pretty heated clash with the business and political establishment in Flint. And at the end of the day, Bacon was run out of town on a rail, and Flint turned down the federal money. But this was where he came from, and he came back to Philadelphia and got a job working for a nonprofit affordable housing advocacy group. So Ed Bacon very much came from this idea of architecture and design as social planning, focusing on affordable housing and planning for the poor and urban workers. And this was the context he brought into his job when he eventually became city planning director in 1949. If you look at what the Philadelphia City Planning Commission did in the early years of Bacon's tenure, it was very much focused on the same kind of philosophy of trying to empower neighborhoods, affordable housing, redeveloping low-income neighborhoods. And in many ways, it directly conflicted with how the federal government wanted urban renewal dollars to be spent. The formula for urban renewal was essentially that the federal money subsidizes the cost of clearing slums, wholesale bulldozing them, and then rebuilding in partnership with a private redeveloper. And Ed Bacon was very much opposed to wholesale bulldozing. He believed that there should be some demolition, but it needed to be very selective, that you needed to restore historic buildings, especially community anchors, and that there needed to be a large degree of community involvement in the planning process. And there are a number of articles during this period in the early 50s talking about how different Philadelphia's approach was from every other city in the country and how it was a more sympathetic and community-based approach. And so in many ways, it actually was similar to the approach that many planners favor today, which is very much focused on involving communities and in reinvesting in existing neighborhoods. And the reason that the Philadelphia approach ended didn't really have to do with Bacon as so much as it did with the federal government in 1954 adopting a new federal housing bill that reallocated how the money was to be spent, focusing it more towards commercial development, urban centers, universities. And so Philadelphia shifted along with the federal priorities. So what I would say is that a lot of Bacon's work that he's associated with was downtown projects and kind of these large-scale planning visions. But at least early in his career, he brought a very strong focus on community development, and he came as sort of this Roosevelt liberal with this strong focus on affordable housing and planning for the poor. So I think in that way, it really did set him apart from a lot of these big city redevelopment czars, who I think came in with a different overall focus.
This is just such an interesting book on so many levels. One that I can strongly recommend. Is there another book in you? Are you working on another? I know that your work has taken a turn in some ways, but do you see another book coming up from you, either about Bacon or about another figure in this era?
Well, as you said initially, I'm not an academic and I'm not primarily a writer. I'm an economic development consultant and I do urban real estate work. And so this book was fairly challenging to research and write. And I'm not sure I would take on another academic book anytime soon. But there are a number of figures and historical events that I bring up in my book that I really do hope other people will write about. I donated all of my research materials to the University of Pennsylvania's Architectural Archives, and I hope that others will go and go through that material and focus on some of these other people and events, people like Oscar Stanarov. I could spend an hour giving that list, but there are a whole bunch of people and events who I think really should be written about, and I hope that my book inspires a new set of literature on Philadelphia's 1950s, 60s planning, on these other figures, and even on different parts of Bacon's career that I didn't have enough time to focus on because of the constraints of the book. My book really focused on his role as city planning director in the 50s and 60s, but after he retired from the City Planning Commission, he started this whole campaign called the Post-Petroleum City, where he went around the world giving lectures and writing articles about an urban future with no private automobiles, where peak oil has occurred, we have no more petroleum fuels, and our cities return to infrastructure that's totally bicycle, mass transportation, and very concentrated downtowns where people can walk, which was pretty progressive for the time. So that's one period. You could write a whole book about, Bacon's campaign to rid the world of private automobiles, for example. Or his early work in Flint, you could write a whole book on that. So I do think there are a lot of other works that could come out of this, and I hope they do, but I'm not going to be writing them. To answer your question, though, for myself, I would like to at some point write another book about strategies for urban economic development based on some of the work that I'm doing now and projects that I'm involved in.
Well, I hope that you come back if that book comes out, and also if these other books that are generated out of this legacy that Bacon has left and that you've left in these archives, it absolutely sounds like there's some great research to come on this. Until then, Greg's book, Ed Bacon, Planning, Politics, and the Building of Modern Philadelphia, is published by University of Pennsylvania Press this year. I hope people go out and read it, both political scientists and also others interested in planning and architecture. Greg, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. I appreciate it.